Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Thursday, September 15th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available on the Internet absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. It's a description and explanation of the tool called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 18 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. You can click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often, primarily because it's been our experience that when people get access to those tools and actually apply them in their lives, it makes their lives better. And secondarily, somewhat selfishly, we enjoy when people do that because it tends to lead to comments and questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, you can give us a call, 563-999-3581. When you call that number and press 1, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And we appreciate when people do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. Our intention with this work is to be of service. And if there is some way we can be of service to you, please let us know. Even if I'm in the middle of talking, reading something from the Way of Mastery, or what might seem to be a monologue, we are encouraging people to call that number and press 1. I'll either turn on the microphone and announce you by area code right away or when it seems to fit the flow of the show. And I should mention before I get too far into things today that today is a Thursday, and that means we have a support group. Support group offerings are on Tuesday and Thursday nights from 5:30 until from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And That'd be 5:30 Mountain Time, I guess. And they're available absolutely free through Zoom. You can donate if you choose, but there's no requirement for payment. And all the information about how that you can join us on Zoom is available at MindShiftersAcademy.org website. MindShiftersAcademy.org. And if you choose to go there and look up the support group information, please remember there's a separate login page and information for Tuesdays and Thursdays as two separate IDs. We occasionally have people who try to join on a Tuesday with the Thursday information or vice versa. It doesn't go so well. So we encourage you to join us yourself, and or if you know somebody who might benefit from it, pass along the information. Again, it's absolutely free. It's out there for anybody to discover. But there aren't a lot of people who are just flipping around and landing on the MindShiftersAcademy.org webpage, or that they would understand what value there might be in the support group attendance. So if you know somebody that you think might benefit, please pass the information along to them. As Michael is fond of saying, his mission, and Jeannie later on joined him in this mission, but he was saying this even before he met Jeannie. His mission is to get these tools into every mind, heart, and being on the planet. And he understands that he's not going to be able to do that one-on-one with the over 7 billion people that are on the planet. And so he expresses gratitude for anybody who picks up the tools, uses them, improves their own life quality, and or shares it with somebody else, because that's the only way this is going to happen is through a grassroots approach of people waking up bit by bit, one person at a time, to the awareness about these tools and then the ways to use them to most efficient effect in their lives. So feel free to join us in the support group tonight. Feel free to join us in spreading the word about these tools. Feel free to join us on the internet call today and raise a comment or a question, 563-999-3581. Again, if you call that number and press 1, I will see the little icon of a hand by your phone number and announce you by your area code as I turn on the microphone. Also, if you're hearing this in the archives and you want to ask a question, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And today we are in our third day. We begin the third day of reading Lesson 21. In the Way of Mastery. And I mentioned before starting this that Lesson 21 and Lesson 22 offer some of the more intense exercises, specific exercises, out of the entire book. Maybe not the most, but some of the most. And literally, Lesson 21 begins with 9 possible statements to use as targeted journaling posts. And we've talked about that, and now we're on the page where it's talking about a new section titled Establish a Relationship with the Comforter. What is the Comforter? Well, Guy Finley talks about it this way. Guy Finley says, your creator didn't put you in a world where if you study for years, if you journey to a cave in the Himalayas, If you're lucky, you can find a teacher who will answer your questions. Guy Finley says, the Creator put you in a world where your instant, constant connection to the wisdom that can guide you will never abandon you if you just ask to be shown. You ask to be taught. So the Comforter in the ancient Aramaic was known as Ruka Dekucha. Ruka Dekucha. Now, Michael and his team of Aramaic experts analyze that word and understand that most of the words that are in Aramaic can be translated, accurately translated, in a variety of different ways. I think Dale Ellen Hoffman has said about the first line of the Bible can be accurately translated 300 different ways. And it doesn't mean that any of them are wrong. It just means that in a certain context, when you're using this word or this phrase, when you add a little dot or a chittle here or there, it changes its meaning. Or you put it in the context between two other words, it changes its meaning. So it's a really powerful language. Michael Rice talks about it as an energy systems language. But the phrase Ruka Dekucha was translated to something in Greek and then into English as the Holy Spirit. And one of the tips that we were given from scholars, practical scholars like Dr. Rice and Dale Ellen Hoffman is, if you want to get a closer idea of what was being said in the Bible, if you go into the New Testament, not leave the Old Testament where it is, but working with the New Testament and the teachings that were coming through, one of the things you can do to get a better idea about what was really being referred to in the Bible is everywhere where you see the word Spirit or Holy Spirit, substitute the word breath. Breathing, to be breathed, to have the flow of life through the breath. The present moment consciousness that focuses on this breath, the breath of life. That with which, without which we cannot maintain an animated physical body. And Ruka Dekucha from the ancient Aramaic and the translations that Michael Rice and the team at the Kabor's manuscript did, the interpretation they chose, the translation slash interpretation they chose for that was an elemental force specific to humans that's in you. It may not be active right now, it may be latent, but it's specific to humans and it's there to break off the effects of your errors in thought. Think about that phrase, to break off the effects of the errors in thought and to guide you to truth and happiness or peace and happiness is in you, and it will become active if you simply ask to be shown. Now, that we're going off on a bit of a tangent on the word, the phrase, the Comforter. What is the Comforter? The Great Comforter is your connection to this wisdom, to this breath of life, to this animating intelligence, your source, the Christ mind, the one mind, the impersonal life. It goes on and on. You can create all of these different words for it, but it's all the same thing. You have the breath of life in you. You have something that's beating your heart and digesting your food and keeping your breath moving even when you're not thinking about it, and that is the force of life that is connected to an intelligence and a wisdom that can guide you and help you break off the effects of any errors in thought, any mistakes in judgment you've had, if you simply ask to be shown. That's what they're referring to as the Comforter. The Holy Spirit, the one mind, the Christ within you, the Christ mind. Your inner guide, whatever you want to call it, your insight, your intuition, your gut feeling, what you call it isn't important. The fact that it's there and will never abandon you, if you are willing to ask to be shown, if you're willing to understand that your conscious logical mind is an extraordinarily limited, very basic tool that has very limited applicability in your emotional life, in your mental emotional life, in your spiritual life. But there's an entire universe, realm upon realm of experience that you can tap into and open up to if you learn to only pick up the conscious logical mind in limited times and spaces for specific achievement of specific tasks, and then you put that tool down when you're done with it. And you go back into awareness of the breath, and you go back into the meditation, and you go back into the direct observation that you don't truly know with your conscious logical mind what anything is or is for. And that the deepest of understandings can only come to you when you recognize what this book would have has called already for us our divine ignorance. So this section is titled Establish a Relationship with the Comforter, with your internal guide, with your connection to the one mind. And the text reads, I highly recommend that you establish a relationship with the Comforter as though it were a relationship with a good friend, indeed the best of friends, and establish and work with that relationship until you reach a point in which virtually every decision is given to that mind. Now, this is going to shake up anybody who was raised in the Western world. This is going to shake the foundations of who and what you think you are. And if it doesn't shake the foundations of who and what you think you are, you don't understand what they just said. So I'm going to read it again. I'm going to read it slowly. I'm going to ask you to think about how a dramatic, radical shift this would be. The text says, I highly recommend that you establish a relationship with the Comforter as though it were a relationship with your best friend, your absolute best friend. Work at establishing that relationship until you reach a point in which virtually every decision is given over to that mind. The text goes on and says, quote, well, old buddy, should I turn left or right? Close quote. Now, our Western mind and this language that we were given to formulate, as this book has already pointed out, is a language of division, a language of separation. It's a language that lets us define ourselves against comparison to other people and things and ideals, and that as we've been taught and coached to believe that we are our thoughts about ourselves and that we have thoughts about other people and that's who they really are. And this work in this paragraph is saying, you know what? We highly recommend that you establish a relationship with the Comforter, which basically recognizes that of yourself you know nothing. And so you're asking to be shown all day, every day, what's yours to do here? What is this for? What does your brother or sister need? How can you be a blessing to yourself and others in this moment? How can you extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful? Oh, look, somebody just rammed in the back of my car while I was at a stoplight, minding my own business. being a good defensive driver. You can't defend against somebody ramming into the back of your car. I take a breath and I say, oh, I wonder how I can extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful in this moment. The other part of my mind is saying, oh my God, you just had that car fixed from the last person that ran into you. Where are you going to get the money for the deductible? This person was probably on their cell phone. This is idiotic. Our world's going to hell in a handbasket. I can let that part of my mind be there, and I can watch its movement of thought without being moved by it. I can take a breath and calm myself and ask again, how can I be a blessing to myself and others in this moment? I can get out of the car and be loving and respectful and offer loving support to the person that just smacked into the back of my car. I can be a conduit for the loving, respectful, creative gratitude energy in that moment. I can bring a loving presence into the field of energy if I ask to be shown, if I ask the comforter, well, old buddy, what should I say and do here to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful? Well, this is, as I'm sure you can tell, very different from what the conscious, logical, Western-trained mind would say. Reach into the glove compartment, pull out the paperwork that says what to do in case of an accident, you know, call your attorney right now, call the police, get somebody out here as a witness, don't get out of your car, this person might be a dangerous person, on and on and on with the thoughts from the conscious logical mind that they aren't bad, they aren't even necessarily wrong, but they don't begin at the beginning, which is how can I extend the energy of love and creation in this moment to everyone and everything around me? If I begin there, then all of these other details about making phone calls and making sure the police get the right answer and we've exchanged information about insurance and I'm not leaving myself open to a lawsuit. All of that will happen if I begin with what Guy Finley would call the first excellence, connecting to my inner guidance and source, understanding that there's a lot more going on here than my conscious logical mind can track, much less fully understand, much less be in control of. So the next paragraph says, here's what this means. It means that you relinquish ownership of your life, period. There the Western mind is already screaming. You relinquish ownership of your life. It is only your ego that thinks it can possess life. Your spirit, your essence knows life possesses it. That is, life has birthed you. The mind of the Creator has given rise to you. You are a part of creation. You are not the owner of life. You are the recipient of it. You have been given the gift of consciousness and the gift of life. Goes on and says, would you then be willing to make the decision to become a grand master of allowance? The answer for most of us is no. Let's just be honest right at the beginning. The answer for most of us is no. I am not willing to become a grand master of allowance. I still need to drive my life. I still need to find a way to make $1 million. I still need to find a way to become famous and get more people to attend the support group or this internet show. I still need to make a name for myself in the field of psychology. I still need to get my sons to behave more the way I think they should and do what I think they should with their lives. I still need fill in the blank. when you take a book like this and you slow down and recognize what they're actually saying, you don't just read past it, what's the answer to the question, would you then be willing to make the decision to become a Grand Master of Allowance? The answer is no. How do I know that's true? Because most of us haven't been doing 5 minutes every day to sit as a Christ. Most of us haven't been doing 5 or 10 minutes every hour to recognize how little we actually know about the world around us and what we need or somebody else needs. Most of us haven't been doing the exercises from the last few lessons. That's how I know. That's how we know. This work is in antithesis of, it's directly oppositional to what we were trained to do in the Western mind. So the text reads, would you then be willing to make the decision to become a Grand Master of Allowance? If so, you can begin with the simplest of things, such as, quote, I allow this toothpaste to taste exactly the way it tastes, with no complaint. It just is as it is, close quotes. I allow this, or in an earlier session it talked about in lesson 5, 4, and 5, I allow this toast to be burnt. I allow this garden that I planted to be all wilted and moldy. Well, look what I did. That was my creation. Okay, that's what it is. I take full responsibility for it. I might as well go to the grocery store and get some food because I'm going to be awfully hungry if I stay here at the garden since all the things I planted went bad. Allowing is not what we are taught in the Western mind. The text goes on and reads, if it is the changing of your seasons, would you be willing to not lament the end of summer and the coming of fall, but would you be willing to just be with and experience that change? For rest assured, and it says here, please listen well. In the realm of the world, which is the realm of perception, the only thing that exists is constant change. Underneath it, there is a changeless reality, that which pervades the changeable. But where there is resistance to change, rest assured, where there is resistance to change, there is a mind living in delusion. That's a powerful statement. Rest assured, where there is resistance to change, there is a mind living in delusion. The text goes on. Remember that we have said unto you before that the awakened mind no longer feels any resistance to the things of time. We've said to you before that the awakened mind no longer feels any resistance to the things of time. It no longer tries to get rid of time. It no longer tries to make things stay the same. The awakened mind can embrace all things, trust all things, and thereby transcend all things instantly, even in the midst of change. I found myself talking about this several times in the past few days on this internet show. If I don't move into allowance more and more, I find myself thinking of myself as a slave to time, as a victim of time. And yet, life just keeps expanding. It just keeps flowing. And as Michael Singer points out in his work, it's a far more enjoyable way to live life to just watch the flow of life events and the experiences that your heart can usher you into these intense emotions, to watch it like you would watch a symphony playing or a sports team, you know, two sports teams playing where you have no investment in who wins and loses. You can just appreciate the athleticism and the teamwork and all the pageantry. It's far more enjoyable to experience life that way than to be constantly contracting and judging and resisting life. Because as this text just said, where there is resistance to change, there is a mind living in delusion. So the beginning of that paragraph again says, remember that we have said unto you before that the awakened mind no longer feels any resistance to the things of time. It no longer tries to get rid of time. It no longer tries to make things stay the same. The awakened mind can embrace all things, trust all things, and thereby transcend all things instantly, even in the midst of change. In your realm, be perfectly honest with yourself, it says. Be perfectly honest with yourself. Is there ever a moment in which change is not occurring? Can the body be the field of perfect silence? Hardly. Even if you make your heart stop beating for 3 seconds, there's still blood gently flowing through the veins. There are still thoughts arising, sounds coming in through the ears. The body is not that which is changeless. The body is not that which can be changeless. The awareness of the body, the field in which the body arises, is changeless already. Come then to be the field of awareness that can embrace all things which arise, because everything that arises changes and passes away. But can you watch that and embrace it and yet not feel any obstruction in embracing and dancing with those things? For the mind that is free from illusions of death is that very mind that learns to dance with death, to enter into any moment or relationship knowing that because the body is engaged, it must come to an end. In fact, it is already on its way to death. The mind, then, that becomes the one who is no longer in fear, no longer in resistance, is the mind that has forgiven all things, including itself, meaning it has dismantled all perceptions about everything and itself. Because the thought and the word are not the thing. My perceptions about something are not that thing. My perceptions about a person are not that person. But the mind that becomes the mind who is no longer in fear, no longer in resistance, that is the mind that has forgiven or dismantled all of its perceptions about all things, including itself. The mind that can embrace all phenomena that arise and pass away with passion, with joy, with aliveness, with innocence, with simplicity, that mind cannot taste death. It literally transmutes death, even as death seems to be passing by. The highest state of being, then, is always a paradox when you try to think about it. Through your desire, you have come ever closer and ever deeper into the kingdom. And through your cultivation of allowance, the grace-filled willingness to know that that which arises is already passing away. It is like water flowing through a fork, and you might as well not lament it. The mind that laments is the mind imprisoned in delusion. The mind that allows all things is the mind that is already freely beyond all things. Imagine that there's been given unto you a window as though your creator had plucked you out of himself and said, I'm going to drop you into the field of time because there is something I want you to learn. You now have 30 days in which to learn it, close quotes. Imagine if you did not learn it, your existence would be snuffed out, erasing your name from the book of life. Now, of course, that will never happen. This is just a way of getting leverage on yourself. The next section reads, cultivating the grace of allowing. Imagine that for the next 30 days, all that mattered was the cultivation of the grace of allowing. If that were the case, how would you do that? By coming down once again to the most concrete, most mundane, most ordinary experiences of any given day. When you turn on your water in your shower in the morning, you actually take the time to be present and to feel its coolness change to heat and to recognize that you have just observed the constant dance of change in your world. And you simply say, quote, I allow this change to occur. Close quotes. Now, yes, it makes you sound like you're some great being, when in fact it is going to happen anyway, but have fun with it. This is about retraining your thoughts, your mind, your conscious logical mind, and its habit of thought. If you burn your toast, take a deep breath, and before the egoic mind begins to complain and whine about its toast not being the way it wants, just stop, just look at it, actually experience the burnt toast and say, I allow this toast to be burnt. And now I'm free to choose to eat it as it is or begin anew, close quote. If you get into your automobile and you pull out of your garage and the raindrops are hitting the windshield, simply give yourself permission to bring your mind back from its future or its past reminiscences and bring it into the present moment and say, quote, I allow the falling of the rain, close quotes. It is that simple. So you see, the power of transformation is the transformation of consciousness, which is the only thing that can be transformed. Learning is a consciousness thing. It is the only thing that can be changed. It is the only place learning can occur. And all learning is designed to translate perception so that it becomes more and more and more and more like actuality itself, like the reality itself. Dr. Rice uses the term reality as synonymous with the perception you create. And he chooses to use the word actuality as what actually is, the real world. In this book, when they capitalize the word reality, they're using it the way Michael Rice uses the term actuality. So learning is a consciousness thing. It is the only thing that can be changed. It is the only place learning can occur. And all learning is designed to translate perception so that it becomes more and more and more and more like actuality itself. Fear dissolves from the mind, and then the creator can take the final step for you. Learning is necessary in the field of perception. You have placed yourself within that field. So why not get on with it and let perception be healed? Let perception be questioned and dropped and purified and clarified until it's what the spiritual faculty of true perception, as Michael Rice talks about it. It is healed by bringing the power of observation to what is right in front of you, not in front of the body, but right in front of the field of awareness itself. That is why you should be dancing in your shoes at all times. Here's a quote. Here's a suggested quote. My goodness, I don't have to go anywhere. It's right here in front of me. This ordinary moment provides the doorway to the transformation of consciousness itself. All I have to do is bring a little willingness to it. And guess what? I have all the power under heaven and earth to do just that. Nobody can take it from me. Nobody can change the freedom in which I live. I am the one who can bring that little willingness to this moment and let the raindrops hit the window. Close quotes. If you will look around yourself, you will discover in any given day plenty of things to keep you occupied. Plenty of things right in front of you. Reasons why boredom is nothing more than a decision. For right in front of you is the richness of a pathway translated by the comforter from a dream of separation into the royal highway to the kingdom. And all the power under heaven and earth lies within you in this moment. And in this moment. And in this moment to choose again. But it is time to take such statements out of the realm of abstract intellect into the very concrete lived moments of your life. Quote, where can I choose again? Right now, I can accept and allow these raindrops to hit the window. I can be present with them. I can hear them. I can watch them as they trickle down instead of being annoyed, instead of letting the mind go off into its future adventures. I can cultivate the art of being present now as the very presence of a mind that is free, close quotes. Therefore, consider in each of your next 30 days, what could I utilize in this day to practice this exercise? Of course, you cannot be without things to practice with. It is impossible. Those that say they are bored are really saying, quote, I am resisting the kingdom, close quotes. It's just that simple. Well, do we perceive once again that so many in your world seek to find spirituality that will free them from the world of their experience, never even realizing that that very attitude is the thing that chains them, imprisons them in their hell. Spirituality is merely a process of seeing things differently. And that is an active decision. It's born of desire, coupled with the little willingness called allowance, to recognize that in each moment, it is like a jewel presented on a golden plate to you. You are creation's offspring. You are the one who has the freedom, always, and you literally create or make your own experience. The final lesson that I had in time concerning allowance was the crucifixion. Now I know there are many of you that do not want to follow in my footsteps, but rest assured, beloved friends, if you would look well upon your experience, you've already tasted much more profound crucifixions many, many times. In fact, for some of you, my crucifixion was a cakewalk by comparison. You are free to crucify yourself no longer by choosing to transform your very experience by bringing the power of your mind to bear upon it. Desire and allowance. So what stands between you and the goal you seek? The decision. The decision to try to be insane. The decision to try to resist creation. You know that you can resist another body since another body occupies another piece of space. In other words, it is not where you are, so you can resist it. But I say unto you, creation is already wholly present right where you are. How on earth can you resist what is already occupying the space in which you find yourself? You might as well try to shake your hand off your arm, or shake or jiggle the skin off your body. good luck. Here's a line that might be worth repeating or writing down. All suffering is the resistance of reality. All suffering is the resistance of capital R reality, is the resistance of what actually is. All awakening and healing is the letting go of resistance. All awakening and healing is forgiveness and allowance. Here's a suggested quote. God is already here. I am God's. I surrender. Creation is already here. It's already around me. I'm a part of creation. I am forever a part of creation, and I surrender to that actuality. Surrender is the fruit of allowance. Surrender is the fruit of forgiveness. Surrender is the same as the atonement, as the at-one-ment. For now, simply focus on allowance, on the allowance to make sure that you have not left some dark corner in the mind filled with your need to perceive things in a certain way. Your need to believe that the world should be other than the way it is, or your fretfulness that each event that transpires in your experience can be seen as heaven or hell. As you choose to see only heaven, you will discover the power that has already set you free. The message of this lesson is quite valuable if you will put it into practice. After all, what else could you possibly want to use time for? You've tried everything else and found it lacking. You've not been able to fill it up with enough lovers, enough money, enough cars, enough restaurants. So you might as well fill it up with the transformation of consciousness, so that perception begins to be more and more and more and more aligned with the actual world, capital R, real world. Why not? Why not align your perception with the truth of all that is? And if somebody asks you, well, what do you do with your time? You simply say, I grow Christ. What do? I grow the Christ consciousness. I extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. What do? So practice well. Begin with the statements given to you at the beginning of this lesson. They are very important for you as a way of triggering the opportunity to observe what might be unlike truth still lingering in the mind and in the emotional field, which is really just the space of glue in which you attach perceptions. It's like pinning the tail to the donkey. Stick that one to the wall and keep it forever. Let those things bubble up that they might be purified from your holy mind. Above all, beloved friends, remember, there are no mistakes. You are free to trust the momentum that seems to be shaping your life, for you are the one who has complied with it by inviting the Holy Spirit to take you home. You are the one that has prayed for acceleration. Therefore, also be the one who accepts the grace being offered unto you. Remember, resistance is the ego, embracing is of Christ. The one that follows all things, allows all things, has already transcended all things. Let this lesson become a month-long journey of exploration for allowing and transcending. Be you therefore at peace this day. Amen. So that is the first read-through of Lesson 21. And again, it should be said that Lesson 21 and Lesson 22 offer two of the more powerful exercises in this entire process, as far as I'm concerned. And if one would take on the challenge of writing and responding and in this targeted journaling way to the nine statements at the beginning of this chapter or lesson, one will stir up all kinds of things that it did not know were embraced by its mind. So we have about 9 or 10 minutes left, and we have a hand up, area code 314. You're in the air. Who do we have?
Hello, this is Doug. How are you?
I'm good, Doug. Thanks for calling. How can we support you today?
I just so enjoy this, what you're doing, I mean, this reading, but I just want to sort of bring forward, I guess, and it's like when I listen to it, I can see that that is the truth, and more than that, I can feel into the bliss of surrender, and I experience that at times. But also, I keep thinking, well, how can anything be done? Like there is a word they're using for two things that oppose with one another. It feels like a lot because if
a
I'm
paradox.
Asking what a paradox,
paradox,
yeah, yeah, that I'm asking what I can do, what is there for me to do, which implies there's something to do, and then there's accepting everything exactly as it is, surrendering to what is. And I think if I'm surrendering to what is, I just accept everything the way it is, then there's nothing to do. You know, it's like internally I can feel myself constrict as my mind tries to, you know, sort things out, because on the one hand, I think, well, I really find peace in surrender. On the other hand, I think you accomplish nothing by doing that. You know, I can sit in the house and not go out and fix the brakes on the car, and then I won't have a car to drive. Or I can go out and fix them. I can get up in the morning and go to work and have some money and have a nice house or not. Yeah, it's like if I surrender, I can surrender to everything. And I don't know. It's always there for me, that argument. It's like I think I'm here to do something. I'm here to promote. Am I going to help create a common ethics in the nation so that the people can be more productive and at peace? Or am I just going to sit back and say, oh, yeah, it's okay if everybody gets divided and has a civil war or whatever? Yeah, you know, it's like that kind of thing. So I'm going to listen a minute and see what comments you have for me about that. Because I'm trying to get past my own.
You're trying too hard, right? You're trying too hard is
okay.
The thing, right? This is the idea of the sustained incoherence that's mentioned in Michael Rice's seven-step worksheet process. It's a term coined by, what's his name, the physicist, David Bohm. And it means exactly what you're doing right now.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? There, you know, I remember one time about 5 or 6 years ago, we were doing this internet show, and one of these things came up. I think it was Susan Bingham that asked a question. And it put me immediately to mind of a physicist, a prominent physicist, who was also into philosophy. And he was being interviewed by Krista Tippett, one of my favorite interviewers, and he said, well, here's the thing. People get stuck on this because most of us don't understand that every deep truth also contains its opposite. And that's what they're trying to point us to in this work. It seems as though when you wake up and realize in one moment that you are not just your body, in the next moment, you realize you are the body, and that's your way of extending the good, the holy, and the beautiful in this moment. It's a temporary communication device. So while it is not the totality of what you are, it is at the same time what you have to work with. He said, so in physics, here's an example of how each deep truth actually contains its opposite. He said, for years, people had arguments about, is light a wave? Or is light a particle? And they would have these chest-thumping arguments and head-butting arguments about it until they finally developed instruments that were sensitive enough to recognize, oh my gosh, in some situations, light operates like a particle, and in some situations, it operates like a wave. So the conscious logical mind trying to make sense of that will always spin and go nowhere. It wants to know, what's the truth of this? What's right? What's wrong? What should I do here? What should I do that? There, and can I specify?
I just lost you, Dr. Tim. I don't know if it's my technology or if you actually left speaking.
Hi, Dr. Tim. Can't hear you.
Hi, Susan. So good thought.
Hi, Doug. Good discussion.
Hi. So he did disappear.
Yeah.
Okay.
He has a way of pressing familiar buttons and seeing if other people can talk to each other. We had this happen the other day on the radio show. Three or four of us ladies ended up yakking, waiting for Dr. Tim to find his way onto the show again.
Right. Yeah. I recall that.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Hello.
There, you're
there
back.
You are. Yep.
Are we back?
Yes.
I guess you're back.
Okay, so we're down to our last couple of minutes. Apparently, we're having technical problems. Thank you for the call, Doug and Susan, for chiming in. I'm going to start the second hour and see if that runs. And Susan, you have not yet pressed one on your phone. So I'm going to start this. And if you can hear the second hour, which is Aramaicisms Part 4, please press one on your phone so I'll know it's coming through, because I'm sure I'm breaking
right
up here.
Oh, okay. You sound
Ruka.
Like here now.
Ruka de Kutcha. You want to talk about kosher?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, Kutcha, anybody ever heard the word kosher? Comes from this right here. If you look at that in the scholarly sense, what it actually, the word kudsha means is intended for mankind, something that is holistic and whole for mankind. If you look at it just literally as its root sounds, it literally means whole, all-encompassing, all-embracing. This here is the word Holy Spirit. First of all, I mentioned last night a lot about spirit, about how it was more accurately breath in Aramaic, and how breath and spirit were not two separate things back then. That happened when Latin spread itself out across the kingdom, and then all of a sudden you had breath and you had spirit. Now today we're looking for spirit, and we're looking for spiritual things, not realizing that what we're looking for is what is looking. And the greatest way to connect with spirit is, and I said yesterday, if you want to understand Yeshua's teachings better in the first century Aramaic perspective, cross out the word spirit and write breath above it. Sounds very Buddhist almost. That's going to give you a much more accurate understanding. The idea of an outside or somehow disembodied spirit that we can't see would have been such a foreign concept that if he were to talk like that, nobody would even know what he was talking about. Not that everybody understood what he was talking about anyway. So this Ruha here is, that's that word for breath, spirit, energy. It would be pneuma in the Greek, spiritus in the Latin. An elemental force. This is Ruha right here, okay? Now, intriguingly, the word's Ruka. So technically, that means this. Ruka is not technically the force, but rather our experience of it. That's what Ruka is. And I said yesterday that in the first century Aramaic understanding, being feminine, what I feel on my arm is not breath in the way that we think of it. What I feel on my arm is just hot air. Breath in Aramaic, in ancient Aramaic, was not the hot air that moves through my body, but rather my feminine experience of its movement. Everybody breathing right now? I can feel like a... Yeah. That's a lot different, isn't it? Yeshua wasn't pointing to things and saying, do this and don't do that, and look at that word, and walk this and walk that there, and do that there and that right there. He was talking about coming back to the eye within the eye, and realizing that you can actually answer the question, are you breathing or are you being breathed? Ruha breathes you. When you get your breath moving and you allow your temple to open, she, which is what she was called in the first century, someone can just flippantly in the middle of a conversation say she, and people would know they were talking about the Holy Spirit. Ruach HaKodesh, the all-embracing breath of God. And there's a lot of amazing power in this is the word of, is a little prefix, the dalet, which essentially means of, if you put it that way. Interesting. And if you can just be aware of your breath and understand the only reason you can't breathe in any moment is because things are up and resonating. And if you don't know how to forgive, you're never going to be able to open your temple, ever, because there's always going to be residue there. There's always going to be junk that's going to keep that from happening.
And it's interesting when he's talking to Nicodemus about this. Nicodemus doesn't have a clue what he's talking about.
The leader of the Jews.
This is it. And Yeshua says, what? You a leader? You don't understand this? And then notice what he defaults to. He then explains to him an elemental force. This word is used to describe all of the elemental forces. And in particular, there's one for humans, but he gives Nicodemus the example of this elemental force called the wind. And he says, you know it came from somewhere, and you know it went somewhere, but you don't know it directly. You can only know it by the effects that it creates. And so in each of us, there is this elemental force for that which is proper for humans. And if you turn yourself over to that energetic flow in you, then that power will process those things out of your structure. Ruach HaKodesh. We could say in our modern language almost a superprocessor. Nicodemus wasn't aware of the superprocessor. And it's interesting to watch how the Greek fear-based translations can turn things so backward. So we hear about this, and over the years I've worked with so many people who, I remember one man who was in his 70s, and he was starting to look at, thinking about, you know, my lifetime is getting short, and he was sure that he was going to hell for eternity. Because as a young man, as a teenager, he did what he considered to be the denial of the Holy Spirit. And he was sure that that's where he was going to burn for eternity. And there's nothing in the Aramaic about the denial of the Holy Spirit is the unforgivable sin, or the denial of the force for that which is proper. What it says is, in essence, let's kind of do a long form of it. In your carbon-based memory system, your body's structure is made of carbon, 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons, and anything that's put in there that doesn't belong there is stored holographically in every cell and passed from generation to generation. So we've got 4 generations, we're told, in there. That's 31 lives. If you've got 31 lives in there, and then remember again last night, we talked about 10,000 brain cells firing, 9 bits of data can come to conscious awareness in these pictures that we paint behind our eyeballs. How long do you suppose, if there's a pattern in your family system, it's going to take you processing 9 bits of data at a time to get through it? Not likely to happen anytime soon. What that passage says is being explained is that you have a power in you that if you invite her into activity in you, she will process you right down to your genetic toes. The denial of that power will leave you in unforgiveness. You won't have the capacity to process that much information. It isn't unforgivable. There's nothing like that. But if you're not able to call that power into play in you, if you can't acknowledge that it's there and invite it into activity, then you're on your own. And on your own, it's a pretty stuck place to be.
It doesn't work.
But there is literally an elemental force in each of us that if we call it into activity, and you know, when it always amazes me when I watch people do the forgiveness worksheet process from Why Is This Happening to Me Again,
So often somebody starts that worksheet out and there's this big, oh, messy, you know, arms going in every which way, hate, fear, anger, rage, guilt, grief. And literally 4 minutes after they do the forgiveness process, they're like, well, why was that such a big deal? And where did it go? And it's gone. Probably the most common comment that I get from people, I don't know if you've done this when you've done the worksheet with people, but when I ask people, how do you feel after you've done the forgiveness process compared to before? And before, it's all these emotions and all this stuff. And literally 4 minutes later, it's, you know, it's silly that I ever had any disturbance about that. And the truth is, you've never had any disturbance about anything. You've just been disturbed. Your mind can put it anywhere. When you enter into forgiveness and you call on that force for that which is proper, that force for that which is proper can take a lifetime of trauma in 35 seconds or less and disappear it. Don't quote me, is that some kind of literal number? Just disappear it. And on the other side of it, people are laughing at something that they were extremely traumatized about just minutes ago. But you can't do that on your own. Our own pea brain can't do that level of process work. And so when I can acknowledge that power is in me and can move through me and undo what doesn't belong, untie me or liberate me from those things, everything changes.
Oh, yeah. It fits right in with it. So, You know, it's amazing. The Nicodemus thing is funny. He came under the cover of night with his, well, it didn't say with his tail between his legs. You know, the leader of the Jews saying, I heard you're some sort of a big deal and I wanted to come and talk to you. But it's intriguing how when he says the wind comes and goes, you don't know where it's coming from or where it's going to, that word's rucha. And then it says, as it is with spirit. What hand gesture, wind, he can go like this. What hand gesture would he have to make for spirit? You know, what would he have to do? Foreign concept in the first century. He would have probably gone, as it is with rucha, as in breath. Remember, breath and spirit were artificially separated later, not yet. Okay? He probably would have gone, and he also says, of course, you must be reborn of maya and rucha, maya as in water. But intriguingly, that word maya, what it really means is great flowing expanse. It's at the end of shemaya, which is the word heaven. Must be reborn of the all and its movement, its elemental forces. And, you know, there's another thing that's hooked on so often that I get asked about. People say, all right, but what about born again? What does it say in Aramaic? And what I would also say to a biblical scholar is, what does it say in Greek? So, interesting. That phrase in Aramaic, another thing he said in John 3 to Nicodemus, is that you must be metelid man darish. Okay? What does that mean? That word rish or resh means head. Now let me explain what head means, okay? It doesn't mean this. People can say born of the crown chakra. That's nice. It could be that. It could be part of it. This was called the Christ chakra in Gnosticism, okay? That's a good one. That makes sense. But let's look. As a matter of fact, that's what Christos means, open channel of divinity. Now, here's head. In the Gospel of Thomas, not allowed in the Bible, in the Gospel of Thomas, and I will say Thomas is not a person, Thomas is Tumas, which in Aramaic means twin, meaning this is a reflection of the fundamental guy that's been kind of shown for the last couple of decades. Okay, here we're showing a reflection. If you're at the head of a line, where are you? The beginning, right? Or we naturally say beginning first. There's another head on the line. The end. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. I am projected into this world and not of it. Now let me explain head to you. First of all, the head means the beginning. It's the beginning of a cosmic expansion. Okay? The head, as an example, what they asked you, him in the Gospel of Thomas, they said, can you tell us how our end will come? And although it doesn't say chuckle, I assume he probably chuckled and said, okay, have you actually found the beginning that now you're looking for the end? And he said, blessed is the one who takes his place in the beginning at the head. For he will know the end, or the head, or leading edge, and he will not taste death. Remember, he came to crucify the world, the cosmos, Alma. He came to crucify our belief in time and space, and inside and out, and light and dark, and positive and negative. These are all qualities of a singular continuum. They are not anything that is separate, because if you take one away, the other is gone. Okay? And there's actually a word I'd like to share with you. Bereshit. This is the first word of the Torah. It's the first word of the Torah. It's also the beginning of the Gospel of John. One thing a lot of people don't realize is that this is to expand on the idea of the head, the beginning and the end. A lot of people don't realize that the original Hebrew Torah, which of course begins in Genesis, Bereshit, with "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," even higher than 30, 913 clear and distinctly separate ways that you can translate that from Hebrew into English or Hebrew into Greek. Interesting. Not many people realize that this is it in Hebrew, this is it in Aramaic. Same pronunciation. Most people don't realize that the original Hebrew Torah was not words and verses and phrases. That came hundreds of years later. It was actually a string of characters like a mathematical algorithm or a constant like pi. Okay? And it wasn't broken down into the metaphorical storyline of "in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and Adam and Eve and snakes and Cain and Abel and all this other stuff" until hundreds of years, possibly over 1,000 years later. Okay? Because it was just a string of characters. And they didn't read the characters. They toned the characters. They still tone them to this day. Okay? Now, what's amazing about Semitic languages is each letter has a meaning. And it's amazing that the very deep nuance of Genesis is unpacked by the realization that what they would do is they would tone each letter individually unto itself, but the gist was much like Georges Seurat or a pointillism painting. When you're in close, you see smashes of paint, and you get so obsessive about detail, but the key is being able to pull back and holistically see the whole. So they would tone each letter and also be in that flow and be able to, as much as possible, take in the fullest nuance of the text. Now, this is something that's going to unpack the inside-outside beginning and being reborn from the head thing a lot better than you could even imagine that it is. There's a reason why it's at the beginning, and I really think the Gospel of John should have been at the beginning of the canonical Gospels, but of course they put Matthew there because it had all the begatting. The funny thing about all the begatting is they're showing you Jesus' bloodline, right? Right? Who's his father? God. Does he have a bloodline? That's number one. Number two, who's right before Jesus in the bloodline? Joseph, his stepfather. They're not showing you Jesus' bloodline. They're showing you Joseph's stepfather. Hello, McFly. Pick one, y'all. Stick to the story. You go to Luke, they do the same thing, but they do it in reverse, and it goes Jesus to Joseph and goes all the way from Adam to God. It's not his bloodline. That's an example of a secret, something that's right under your nose that you've seen 1,000 times but you never thought about before. There's a lot of that stuff. Now, Beit Resh Aleph Shin Yod Tal, okay? That's what we've got here. Bereshit. Now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to show you very simple process of the letter meanings of each of these letters, okay? And this is just one word we're going to do it with, all right? So I'm going to ask you to just pay attention for just a couple of minutes. It's not going to take long. Now, the first one is Beit or Bet. When you know in the beginning, in the is the word Bet or Beit, okay? Now I'm going to have to erase this. Michael knows I get all excited and passionate about this stuff. He doesn't get excited and passionate, though. Yes, he does. There we go. Woohoo! You trying to erase me? Now, this is what the letter Beit means, okay? And intriguingly, Beit or Beata, it's also a word in Latin. It means this. It means house, okay? Now, this in Proto-Sinaitic, the earliest style of writing that we have, Beit means house. It still does to this day. And it looked like this. It looked like a house. But let me explain something to you. House, Beit, when you know Beit Lachem, Bethlehem, the house of bread. Okay? interesting. House, bait, doesn't mean just a building with bricks and structures and walls. Take a breath. What it means is it's the differentiation between the inside and the outside. The object of my attention appears to have an inside and an outside, light, dark, positive, negative, masculine, feminine. It also means burst open. It's the root of the word blessing. Okay, and I said yesterday, it says that we were born as the original blessing of life itself. Okay, so we've got burst open as its own blessing from inside to its outside. All right, the next letter is resh. Resh is the word head. It means leading edge, or it means source or leading edge. Head, okay? You know what's amazing? The original letter looked like this. It was a neck with a head on it. Interesting. So, next letter is Aleph. Aleph is actually the first letter, well, rather than writing the letter, is actually the first letter of the Hebrew and Aramaic alphabets, and it sounds like this. Listen closely, okay? It doesn't have a sound, technically. It is often pronounced like this, though. Ah, ah. Okay? Now, this aleph is put in words to keep a word in motion. Part of it, there's a symbolic depth to it, which I'm going to get to, but it's not the same as having a space there, even if it's not spoken. But the difference is that you keep it moving, okay? You stay in motion. Now, what aleph meant was ox. Wow, that's the key to the cosmos, is ox. Huh? The original letter looked like this, okay? This was the original letter for Aleph. What does that look like? It looks like an ox. Why? Because then and now, the ox was considered to be an animal in agrarian societies, agricultural societies, that was so tremendously powerful because it didn't just have strong haunches or shoulders or back or legs, but rather that it gained its tremendous strength only when it was in a state of absolute wholeness. Strength only comes when we are holistic and whole. That's where power comes from. That's where all power comes from. That was represented by the sound ah, which was aleph, which is everything. It's the whole ball game. You getting what I'm saying? And then we've got the letter shin, or sheen. Now, what's interesting about this one, I'm just going to put it below, it looked like this. This is literally the original letter. It meant shine, sheen, or express. It was a lip with teeth underneath it. We're going back about 8,000 to 10,000 years right now, okay? It means shine, sheen, or express. Whoa. The next letter was yod, which means hand. When it says in the Gospel of John, nothing existed except through his hands, beyada, ada, or yeda in Aramaic, that doesn't mean that God's got a workbench up there and he's building the world. What it means is everything you see is God. There's no outside God. There's no outside presence. There's no all-powerful anything except that which you have not opened up your awareness to. Okay? But that yod means to reach out. It means to reach out. The original letter looked like this. It was an arm with fingers on the end of it, a hand, and it meant reach out. And then the last letter looked like this, just two lines next to each other. That word means reflection or echo of itself. Now, if you just look at the word Bereshit, and then I'm going to turn this back to Michael, this is just the first word of the Bible, okay? You've got Reshit, which is a woven net that a fisherman would use, and the Reshit, or Reshit, it would be squeezed down, and they would throw it, and it would go like this. Reshit, that's what Reshit means, the casting out of a net. Okay? In the middle is Resh, which means head, or leading edge. Reshi literally means at the leading edge of the rushing headwaters. Kind of like you're going down a mountain stream and you're surfing the leading edge of the cosmos. You ever have that feeling when you're so fully, wholly present right now in this moment at your center that you feel as if you're at the leading edge of all creation? That's what it means to be born again.
Literally, looking at this word, there's also Ash or Ash, which is an expanding fire, bursting open as its own blessing from the head or leading edge of everything to shine, sheen, express, and reach out to become its own reflection. That's just the first word of the Bible. Do you think maybe we missed something? That's what wholeness means. You get it? I got the vapor.
And you can't figure it out.
Yeah, your brain can't hold it. Forget it.
You got to be in the energy of it. You're triggering me the memory of something that Carl Jung said that I think was so powerful. And he says, who looks without. And of course, looking without means you paint a picture on the inside of your eyeballs and you think you're looking at something out there. Who looks without dreams. Who looks within awakens. And when you start looking within, when you let this take you within, when you let your breath take you within, then everything is transformed. Everything changes. And there comes a space for wholeness into this expression. Pretty cool. And you can't do it by keeping your attention on what's in your brain. You actually have to ultimately repent. Does that mean you have to proclaim yourself a worthless sinner and a...
Repent! Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I don't want to do it.
So it means to turn another way. You look at people who are looking without, as Carl Jung said, we think it's out there, and we're in a dream. We're stuck. We're lost in a dream. And you want to turn your vision 180 degrees in the other direction. To look within and see that the source of the world that you live in, the source of the construct, for those who weren't here yesterday, we quoted from a CIA website where they're working to understand how to get the best perception possible from their analysts to get the best intelligence possible. And what they literally say is that we do not record reality, we construct reality. And every reality that you see through your body's eyes is painted on the inside of your eyeballs from what's moving inside of you. If you never get beyond what's painted on the inside of your eyeballs, then you'll live forever in a dream. And the horror, the dream of the world is, somebody else did this to me, and therefore I'm hopeless, I'm helpless, there's nothing I can do. When you give up looking without at the dream and you repent, you turn in another direction, you awaken from the dream because you're now directly in touch with the root of the dream. You bring your human life, the active presence of love and the breath, to the dream, and the dream starts to dissolve. Then you get a set of directions that comes from a different place. You know, we spoke yesterday about the Creator. They say the Creator is omnipresent. If the Creator is omnipresent, is in every corner of the universe, there's that active presence of love. And the physicists, as we said yesterday, tell us that every molecule in the universe is in continuous communication with every molecule in the universe. Is it possible that when we can collapse our preoccupation, that is, forgive our preoccupation with what's out there, drop within and remove it, then we move into whole field perception, where we are literally guided by these energy forces that come from the Creator through the whole creation, and therefore we are, our structure, our realities are structured out of literally the energy field of the Creator, the mind of the Creator, rather than the mind of your body. When you move there, you get to live in the present. And the reason they call it a present is because whenever you're there, there's a gift, there's a present. And it is that active presence of love that will clean up everything in your structure that never belonged there. Thoughts?
Just one little piece, literally. Just two little pieces then, okay? You know, one of the things that I had a dear friend, this is going back in the early 90s, his name was Michael Talbot. We lost Michael to leukemia, a really rare form of leukemia. I had such an
amazing relationship with him. He lived up in New York City. He had a book that he wrote called The Holographic Universe. And one of the things about Michael is he did lots of research into the holographic nature of reality, which, of course, has been something that's been out there for probably 100 years really fully formed on one level or another. But it's an amazing thing that if you take a whole holographic plate that has a three-dimensional image in it, and this is an actual true laser hologram. A laser hologram, you can aim the laser in and actually encode the information in that holographic plate. And if you give just the slightest degree of shift, you can put another whole full image and another one and another and another, another, like these infinite dimensions, the mansions of many mansions that we live in right now. All of these infinite images can be shown in this laser plate. And you shine the laser in at whatever angle it is, and you'll see the one that went in at that degree. What's most beautiful about this is if you take a holographic plate and you drop it, and it shatters into thousands of pieces on the ground, and you shine a laser into every single sliver and splinter that it broke into, you can put it at the exact same angle and see all of those images wholly and holistically in their entirety on each sliver. But there does become a point when the slivers or the breaks become small enough that the laser will no longer be able to perceive the image of holism anymore. There's a point when that doesn't mean it's not there, but it's almost impossible to perceive anymore in the world and locked in it.
Separateness.
Exactly. And that brings me to the second point, which is this. John 3:16, let me just say it clearly without going into all the studies there are that it was actually a right-hand marginal note that was integrated into a copy of it. The Gospel of John, Yohanan, was originally called the Gospel of the Beloved Disciple. John 3:16, everybody, you see it all the time. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believeth in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting or eternal life. And I just would love to just get this one thing out there very briefly, and I'll show it to you in English, okay? This is the word in Aramaic. Yechidaya or echidaya. This is the word in Greek, mono gones. Now, what does mono mean? One. What does gones mean? Gona, birth, born. Only born, only begotten. Now here's an interesting thing, okay? Does anybody know when monogenes was defined as only begotten in John 3:16? We know the exact year that it was given its definition. Monogenes was already in the text of the Gospel of John. They didn't define it until the 4th century in 325 AD at the Council of Nicaea. And they picked four possible definitions and they chose one out of a hat. The one that they chose was only begotten, and Constantine was very clear that the reason they chose it was because Horus was known as only begotten in ancient Egypt, and he knew people would eat the story that much easier. It's not a secret. Research it. Interesting. You know what it means in Aramaic? Yah means who. It's a point back to Yahweh, the oneness, the wholeness. It doesn't mean who as in yoo-hoo, person, but rather the I within the I, the who behind the who. Okay? Chud in Aramaic is literally the word one. It's the word one in Aramaic. It's the number one. Okay? Ayah is an interesting word because it's in many languages. And what ayah means is something that has no beginning and no ending, much like a vine. Something that is growing, 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 and it's one with everything. It's always in a process of oneness. It's always in a process. On one level, it's on a process of oneness. On another level, it's in a process, you know, in what seems to be the physical world of constant growth. It never stops expanding. Yahudaya, one who is absolutely single and one with everything. There's no such thing as a begotten in it. There is no begotten. Because begotten implies what? Two. There's no two in the word. It actually says one. Intriguing. Think of the pain and the torture and the suffering that's been done in the name of John 3:16, because people think other people don't get it, when, bless their hearts, even ministers who have been in the pulpit for 6 or 7 decades of their life and they've gone to the theological institutions and they've got all the numbers and letters behind their name, they don't even know the history of their own religion. I say that with absolute love and peace. It's time for us to wake up, because ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is blindness. And believe it or not, you're the only game in town, because there's only one.
Okay, let's look at the opening words in the book of John. We're told that it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. In Aramaic, it's something much more profound than just speaking a word. There are a couple of different ways to translate it, and one of them is mind energy, and the other one is willed action. And when you think about that, and then, you know, so often now today, we get the benefit of the world of physics and the world of physiology and research that goes into the science of it, and it all starts to make sense. Now, there's a video that we carry with an interview with a fellow named Bruce Lipton, who's a cell biologist. And when I first was introduced to Bruce, it was after I'd done a television interview up in New York, and this gentleman said, are you familiar with Bruce Lipton? This is back 20 years ago, before Bruce was very popular. I said, no. And he says, well, he's a cell biologist, and he's doing the same work you are. It's like, really, a cell biologist doing what I'm doing? And he handed me his video, said, here, watch this. And I was just amazed at what unfolded. And one of the main things that Bruce talks about on that particular video is that when you think a thought, that thought becomes a molecule in your structure. Actually, Deepak Chopra speaks about that action as the non-physical becoming physical. Mind energy becomes flesh. Willed action becomes flesh. And so what he's showing is that you think a thought, and that thought becomes a molecule. The molecule circulates around in your structure until it finds a cell with a receptor site that matches, an antenna that matches, and then it lands on the cell. Now, what the cell biologists are saying is that this cell then replicates the neuropeptide. I don't believe the cell replicates the neuropeptide. If you look at my hands in the other direction, when the molecule finds a cell with a receptor site that matches, it inserts itself in the cell. And what shows up in the cell is what we call chemistry. There's no such thing as chemistry, in fact. What it is the energetic pattern, and this part of it solidified looks like chemistry in the cell, but it's really a whole energetic pattern. And when it comes to forgiveness, and you recognize that your energetic pattern, your multi-generational database, has the mind energy of every generation in your bloodline, the skill that ultimately you need to develop, if you're really going to perfect the skill of forgiveness, is you're going to have to learn to go inside of those cells to decode their content and remove the ones that have become your flesh that don't belong in human form. So the skill to be acquired is a skill of being able to go inside and retrieve from your genetic structure. You know, when the geneticists first started researching, they told us that, you know, it was 95% junk DNA. There's no junk DNA. I think the official numbers are now down to about 60% of its junk. There's no junk. It's just the history of your bloodline. When they said the sins of the fathers will be passed to 3 and 4 generations, again, that word sins is an archery term. It just means off the mark. Anything that's off the mark is an energy that's stored holographically and lands in the cell. It lands in the genes and is passed from generation to generation. And so when you learn the skill of being able to reach in, and it only comes with one of the main skills that Dale's been speaking about. Can I borrow that skill for a minute? Mm-hmm. When you breathe. And that opens the veil, the barrier between what we don't want to be aware of and what we are aware of. There are certain things that we've approved and said, I'm willing to look at this. But when something starts to move in us that we don't want to look at, what we generally do is hold the breath. And holding the breath causes us to dissociate from that mind energy and to no longer be able to decode it. The problem with doing that is because you live in an energetic universe and everything that is in your structure is literally energy in motion and sets up energy waves, then because resonance means motion toward, somebody who's in resonance with that mind energy in you is going to show up in your life. The person with the decoder for what you don't want to decode is going to show up in your life. And you're not going to be happy when they show up because what they do is going to resonate everything you don't want to feel or decode. And so what happens is people shut down the breath. They create an artificial barrier, a veil in their temples. This isn't about a purple curtain in the church when they said the veil of the temple must be rent in twain. The veil is created by locking down and creating this artificial barrier and creating a dissociated mind, a mind that we cannot touch, a mind that is not ours to change. So the very things that you most want to change in your life, as long as you stay in denial, they're hidden from you. And denial looks like you made me. When there's a problem inside that we keep creating pictures of something that we think is outside, then as Carl Jung said, we live in a dream. We live in the dream that everybody else is doing it to us. But there's a really important piece of the puzzle that we miss. While we're out there proclaiming how everybody else did it to us, we're still feeling the pain of it. Now, there's a test we've developed in this work for determining whether or not something you're feeling is yours or not, and the test goes like this. Are you feeling it? If you're feeling it, you know it belongs to only one person. If you have the capacity for hostility, fear, turmoil, rage, guilt, grief, pain, or trauma, it's because it is an energy in your structure. And until you're willing to capture that and remove it, and it is a skill. I remember several years ago, I bought a computer online, got the computer, hooked it up, and there was a problem with it. I called tech support, and the tech support people said, you know, we can't do this over line. You're going to have to send it back to us. So I sent it back, and they ostensibly fixed it. I got it back, plugged it in. It was exactly the same. Got online with tech support, sent it back, and they ostensibly fixed it, plugged it in. It was the same. My son did his computer training with a former NASA computer scientist who was a genius with computers but had several businesses going, and he's a good friend of mine, and I didn't like to disturb him. But after the second time of the company that owned the computer, built the computer, when they couldn't fix it, I called Graham. And, Graham, I've got a problem with this computer. Can you help me? He says, sure. What's going on? And so I explained it to him. He says, well, go to a C prompt. I said, what's a C prompt? And he explained how to get to that. And he gave me a string of characters to type in, and I typed them in. And he said, read that back to me. So I read back what came up. He said, okay, type this in. Read that back to me. What's it say? I read it back to him. He said, okay, type this in. It's fixed. Graham, come on. You're kidding me. No, it's fixed. Well, how come that... Michael, it's fixed. Now, how does a NASA computer scientist know that it's fixed? He's developed such skills. You know where Tiger Woods was today? One of the best golfers in the world. You know where he was today? He was on the golf course. He was chipping shots. He was putting. He was driving. If you want to become a master of your life, if you want life and you want it more abundantly, then you're going to have to go over after that set of skills in the same way as a Tiger Woods or the same way as this friend of mine, Graham, had. And as you develop the skill of breathing in the presence of your trauma, of opening to it and moving it, you open the veil of your temple. You open the barrier between the subconscious and the unconscious. And you have access to those things that never belonged in your bloodline. When you have access to those things that never belong in your bloodline, you remove them, you forgive them. You no longer put those things into your brain's image of your brother. What did Yeshua say? You must forgive from your heart, your unconscious, that which you put into your brain's image of everybody else, and you want to believe everybody else is the source of your disturbance. If you're still capable of disturbance, you have a problem. You ever say to somebody, you made me mad. you hurt me. You disturb me. You really have a problem. You ever say that to somebody? I have a question for you. If they're the one with the problem, why are you the one with the pain? Do you think pain belongs in a device made by love? It doesn't. But your brain can lie to you and make up pictures of how something outside of you is the cause of what's going on inside of you. The skill you need to be developed is the skill of accessing everything that never belonged in your bloodline and removing it so that no matter who shows up, no matter what shows up, you're not capable of pain. That all that is incarnate in your form is the active presence of love, your human life. And if you believe it's about anything else, then you got all kinds of dramas and traumas that you blame everybody else for. And it's time for us to learn to literally remove the capacity for any form of drama and trauma. You must forgive from your unconscious, from your heart, from your dissociated mind, that which you put into your brain's image of everybody else whenever it's triggered. And you'll notice when people do that, they usually start with their enemies. But if there's no enemy handy, they can use their spouse. And if their spouse isn't handy, they can use that child that was so dear to them. Or any object of attention will do. You remember the forerunner to this mind that was in Christ was who? John the Baptist. What did they call John the Baptist? He was the raving maniac in the desert. The desert is another code word for the unconscious. If you want to truly live in the mind of love, you're going to have to meet your John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is the one who can reach into your unconscious and show you everything that you never wanted to deal with, everything that you never wanted to feel. Now, there were two skills, if you ever decide to play that role for somebody, there were two skills that John had not bothered to develop. And that was, before he confronted someone who was living in a lie, who still had the capacity for some sort of turmoil, confusion, or pain, he confronted them, and when you confront someone in that state with truth, their stress goes up. And most people have their stress attached to the source of the information that shows truth, and they want to get rid of it. So John didn't know when to duck and when to hold the mirror up, and they took off his head. Be careful when your stuff comes up to own it and stop taking off other people's heads. Stop talking about anybody else if you're in pain or turmoil. Because talking about someone else when you're in pain or turmoil is called denial. And when you deny, you dissociate. And what you dissociate from is the only thing that will kill you. If there is a frequency in your cellular structure that can cause disturbance or disease, then you need John the Baptist to bring it up for you. And then you need to breathe.
The veil of the temple was rent in twain. The veil in the doorway of the temple was rent in twain from top to bottom. Ape tareia de haikla. The veil of the temple. First of all, you know, he mentioned a purple curtain in the doorway of the church. It's nice, and there's validity in making a building and putting a curtain there and making the inside of that the holiest of holies, and only the high priest can go in there. Whether they actually demonstrate true cosmic love or not, it's just the way it is. Those are the rules. But let's get clear that the holiest of holies is right here. Now, ape tareia de haikla. Haikla is the word for temple. It's the word for church. Haya, I come to give you haya, give it abundantly. Said that yesterday quite a few times. The word save is haya. Salvation is haya. Resurrection is haya. All these different words that have been translated in all these strange sort of evangelical Christian ways, it's all the same word, and every single one means conscious life energy. When you have haikla, kla is the ka and la, it's a gathering of conscious life energy, and that's the body temple. It's also the word for church, a word for church or sanctuary. But let's go back a little bit. Ape tareia de haikla. Tareia is a word that a lot of people skip over. They just say the veil of the temple, but it's the veil in the doorway of the temple. That word tareia means door, doorway, doorkeeper, or portal. A portal is an opening between two dimensions, between two rooms, between the inside and the outside, whatever you say. Portal, interesting. Go back one more word, which is ape, and this is the word for veil. Ape. Now, pe is an Aramaic letter that means from the mouth. Okay? It means from the mouth. Ape. Intriguingly, when Yeshua said, that in which you judge another, you are guilty of practicing, right after that he called them something. What did he say? Called them a hypocrite. Hypocrite. Hypocrite sounds like this in Aramaic. Ape. It means to puff out from the mouth. Ape also means this. It means veil. We just said that. Ape also means sake. Like, for your sake, Johnny, don't run out into the road. What does that mean? For your what? Safety. For your, I would say for your apparent safety. Ah, sounds like A Course in Miracles, talking about the safety of the ego, which has no safety in it whatsoever. So we've got veil, we've got hypocrite, we've got sake, but there's something a little closer to that. It also means person. Person in English comes from the Latin word persona, which means mask. Now the ape in the first century was a mask that an actor would wear in a divine play. They would show up on stage with that mask on, and by the end of the play, they would drop their mask and reveal their true inner light and absolute eternal divinity. When someone heard him say ape, they would not have heard hypocrite. That's an English word. They wouldn't have heard veil. That's an English word. They wouldn't have heard sake. That's an English word. What would have been going on for them was, oh, I get it. It's the mask that we wear. You getting what I'm saying? In other words, it's not you that judges the other. It's your mask. It's your, where the 666 was. It's your anti-Christ. It's anything, Christ, remember, Christos, look in Strong's Greek Concordance, open channel of divinity, okay? If you look at that in Greek. Anything that blocks the portal is antichrist. Anything. Anything that keeps you from being open is antichrist. And you know what's really convenient? If you try to spend decades and hundreds or thousands of years looking and labeling an outside antichrist. Because you know what that does? It enables you to make somebody else the perpetrator. It makes you the victim, and now you can fight against them so that you don't have to take care of any of the dynamics that are already running around in your heart. What is it that Gandhi said? There are no devils in the world except those running around in our own hearts. And I love, Yeshua said in the Gospel of Thomas, that which you bring forth from within you will save you. That which you do not bring forth from within will destroy you. Hmm. Nice.
And they said, take care of the heart, for out of it are the issues in life. Now notice, if you live in the outer eye, you think the issues in your life are somebody else, right? Anybody ever said that to somebody? You made me mad? You made me sad? You made me afraid? Most of the world has this belief that if somebody else hadn't done something, I could be at peace. And that's a lie. The only reason I can't be at peace and in connection with the actual presence of the love that I am and that I live, move, and have my being in is because there's something in me that I don't want to deal with. And that which is in me that I don't want to deal with literally creates a high energy wave that, if it's of a destructive nature, of an hostility or fear-based nature, literally is radiating into every cell of my structure continuously and destroying me. So if I speak a word about my disturbance as being your fault, I'm destroying my own cellular structure. And so it's out of my heart, it's out of what I hold within my own denial system, my own dissociated mind, that energetically draws the issues to me that I need to deal with. And then somebody shows up, and what does virtually everybody in the world do when somebody shows up that resonates their disturbance? Well, let me explain to you what's wrong with you. Let me explain to you what you just did to hurt me, to cause me pain. And Yeshua would say, you must forgive from your heart that which you just put into your brain's image of your brother. And as you go in and remove that, and the basic thing that drives the mind to produce the pictures that it does on the inside of our eyeballs where we talked about 10,000 brain cells fire, 9 bits of data go into perception. Something drives that system. And when you know what drives that system and what to do with it, then you change that whole system. And what drives it is our goals. You'll notice you've never been upset with somebody who's meeting all your goals. If they say everything the way you want them to say it, they do everything the way you want them to do it, they bring what you want them to bring, and they obey every infantile goal you have for them, notice you're quite happy with them. But when someone violates a goal you have for them, what happens is that goal becomes a driver that causes your mind to use your own dissociated content to build a picture on the inside of your eyeballs that makes it look like it's about them. The core of the forgiveness process, but the core of the forgiveness process looks like this. When I load a goal into my mind that causes my mind to use some kind of disturbing energy in me, hostility, fear, rage, guilt, grief, pain, confusion, whatever it is, when I load a goal that causes my mind to move that energy in me, then I build pictures out of that energy of somebody else and talk about them. That's denial. In Aramaic, the word forgive is shabag or shabak, and it means to cancel. When I realize that what's driving my perceptual system to use my dissociated hostility or fear to produce my brain's image of another, I now live in a dream, as Carl Jung said, who looks without dreams. I live in this dream that everybody else is the problem in my life, and therefore there's no resolution. When I recognize it's my goal that drives the dream, then I shabag the goal. I cancel the goal, which seems totally insane. But when I realize that that goal is driving my perceptual system to use my internal information based in hostility, fear, confusion, rage, whatever it is, then by canceling my goal, I collapse the whole projection. And when this projection collapses in on itself, I drop right into the part of my mind that holds the disintegrative energy, the sin, the energy that's off the mark, that doesn't belong in me. So I open a pathway into that dissociated part of my mind, and as I do, I'm able to bring that information, instead of bringing it forward as pictures of everybody else, by going within, as Jung said, now I've awakened. I'm in direct relationship with that energy. I bring it to the presence of active love, my human life. I ask Ruku Dikuncha, the super processor, for support, and all of a sudden I process through that, and my temple is freed from that. I've opened the veil of my temple with forgiveness and removed what didn't belong. And that's all been misinterpreted to be about some kind of building 2,000 years ago. And it becomes irrelevant to who you are today. Are you still capable of any former hostility or fear? Notice that when it comes up, you talk about somebody else. That's the whole game of the world. Buy into the world's denial system and make it everybody else's fault. We can never drop into the part of us that is our disease and heal it. You've got to crack open the veil. It's done with forgiveness. It seems totally backward to have a perfectly wonderful, awesome, sweet, tremendous goal and cancel it. But I collapse the picture that keeps me focused out there, thinking the problem's out there, and I get to drop into where the real problem is. And when I remove what disturbs my peace of mind, then I get to incarnate as a human being. There's work to be done. That part of your mind. And then invite Ruka Dikuja to assist you to process whatever that's about. It's the most amazing process you'll ever see when you actually use it. First century Aramaic forgiveness.
One of the strangest things that I really, that brought up a lot of stuff for me that I had to remove so that I didn't recreate it within my own system, I was flabbergasted when I got deep into some of these scholarly realms and into these rooms, and I was so, it completely made no sense to me how I saw these theological frames and fences that were passed down for thousands of years, and how there was almost no one who was interested in moving those frameworks to the side and say, maybe, just possibly, over the course of 2,000 years, maybe
one little thing here and there. It was possibly not quite correct. Maybe there's just a couple of things that aren't quite completely in high fidelity. But you know what? You can only hold so many corks on a lake down. And now that the internet is out and everything on the internet is true, right? Now that the internet's out here, you can't stop it anymore. It's out there, and it's coming out. And the young ones that are coming in, they don't have the indoctrination. I realize I'm not doing this for us anymore. I'm doing this, honestly, for the young ones. I'm doing this to help us let go and be open and forgive what's in our hearts so that they can come in, and we don't need to indoctrinate them and drug them down and dumb them down and dump all this garbage on top of their heads to feed the economic, political, and religious beast anymore. We can just let them be exactly who they are. And that's exactly what all of the Yeshua teachings are about. And to know that I'm right here beside you, it's like, come on, with Mikael, the great angel himself. So
notice that many of the things that we've said here tonight and last night for your non-being mind are hard things to hear. 2,000 years ago, they said to Yeshua, what do we have to do? What's it look like? And what he said in an idiom was, you're going to have to live like I'm living. You're going to have to live as the active presence of love. But you'll notice that half of his audience left his tutelage, saying, this is too hard a saying to hear. You mean I have to give up my rage, my guilt, my hate, my fear, my confusion, my blame? I have to be responsible for that and give it up and live as love? Too hard a saying, I'm not interested in doing that work, I'm out of here. And half of his audience left. If you found hard sayings here, we're going to invite you not to believe a word that either of us have said. We're going to invite you to take the tool of forgiveness, put them to work in your life, and watch what happens. You'll have your own direct experience. And our goal here is to take you into the direct experience where you're in touch with your inner teacher, your inner tutor. And you live your life as the active presence of love.